It's my experience is you can have two people who are kind of trying, and maybe most of their life is quite mundane and centered on just doing the regular things of life. And then in that moment, when they sing together, suddenly something happens and they become like divinely enthused and infused to be pure and empowered. And then the moment that it ends, it's like, I'm just a human. I'm a deeply flawed human being who has impulses and behaviors and all of these things that are contaminated by the material sphere. But something happens when we sing together that it's like, I'm a divine being. I am divine and I'm perfected. And in this moment, and sometimes it's just like, it can literally be one instant. It's like, for this instant, I am fully realized. This person is fully realized. We're all there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I'm joined by renowned Vaishnav musician, author, and sincere seeker, Bali Rico. Bali is a lyricist, multi-instrumentalist, seeker, and academic. Born in the US to Colombian parents, he and his younger brother Kishore spent their formative years living in ashrams in the sacred land of Mayapur, West Bengal, learning the traditions and music of ancient India. Bali is a co-founder of the kirtan group Mayapuris. His mridanga playing is innovative and dynamic, helping to create the Mayapuri signature sound. As a lyricist, Bali's flow mirrors the intricate rhythm of a born percussionist, with thoughtful prose full of insight, philosophy, and personal reflection. His hip-hop music brings together his eclectic musical influences and unique artistic talent. It was a very warm, profound, rich exchange of hearts with Bali. We talked about, of course, music, about kirtan as a social phenomenon, about how we need each other, and in that communion, we can have an experience that we cannot get by ourselves, about his Vaishnav birth and the challenges of being born in a religious family and meeting the outside world, the gifts of him being a father and what changed in him before and after that, his hip-hop adventure and expression, and how confessional that is, how it gives right to protest, but how behind the protest there's always some sadness and some pain and some grieving and some longing about the role of science even in this material world, in the spiritual practice, and how to put all the things together, how to construct a mature, relatable, sustainable spiritual project informed by other disciplines, even informed by other, not only traditions, but by every single instance that surrounds us in the daily life. So it was a very comprehensive, as you can imagine so far, interaction with Bali. This is the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome again. So to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking into the bell. If you feel inspired, touched, nourished by the conversation, feel free to share it, to like it, to drop a comment in the sections of commentaries, and continue adding your own contribution to this ongoing conversation. Without further ado, my friends, here is Bali Rico. Bali, welcome to the Free Radical Podcast, and thanks for joining us.
Arrivo. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I already had Dani. I was looking forward to having you soon, and soon we will be having also Javi Prabhu, so gradually the whole family is showing up to the table.
If you try and get my side of the family, it will be quite a task, because there's my dad is one of 13 and there's a lot of us.
Okay, I will have guests for a whole year episode, so that's good. That's good to know if I need some resources there. So I like generally to start thinking, remembering, and for a moment, and maybe you may need to remind me how we met, the two of us first time in person. Probably was, of course, my first contact, I think, was through your wife, Dania. Then I visited probably you in Alachua, eventually meeting the rest of the family again, Dania's siblings and your mother-in-law, Javi Prabhu, recently in Mayapur. And I think if that was our first meeting, that was that historical moment when I was crowned by you as a bona fide sannyasi. Remember when you asked me if as an Argentinian, I watched the World Cup final 2022 between Argentina and France. I say no, you didn't believe me first. Then eventually you realized that was true and I was labeled by you as a bona fide sannyasi. So finally Someone who recognizes me for the real reasons.
truly renounced.
Joking, thank you for that. So let me begin with another classical question that I present to my guests. Why you have chosen to join this conversation today, beyond the fact that, of course, I invited you to be here?
I enjoy the progressive spirituality that is kind of growing in our movement. You know, we're maintaining the integrity of the tradition, but allowing ourselves to inspect and introspect on different levels. You know, there's so much kind of knowledge and philosophy that exists in the world, and we can use that to enrich our spiritual progress and our path. I think growing up in a kind of traditional, like many of my peers, in a traditional environment, you know, as a ISKCON devotee, second gen, going to ashrams and gurukul and having the particular texts and the lexicon that we all share, it's nice and refreshing to be able to just discuss and kind of dive in using other worldviews and I think other just paradigms, different paradigms of understanding bhakti. So I think that you're, you know, one of the kind of prominent voices in this like new evolution of you know, the 21st century, how to be a sincere seeker, how to try to actually make an effort to be devoted to Radha and Krishna, and but in a new way, you know. So I'm interested in that, and I like what you say. I've heard many of your lectures and I've read some of your book, and I support you.
Thank you for your support and for being here from a genuine place, and I totally resonate with what you just said. I'm not saying that I'm doing that, but I at least I resonate with that, and that's my aspiration, how we can, as you nicely say, okay, we have an ancient tradition, eternal wisdom, if you will, and at the same time we are coexisting with so many paradigms and so many currents of knowledge and perspectives, and how much we can engage in conversation and do so and create what one of my mentors will say is an alternative orthodoxy, because we don't want to be heretics, so to say, but also there is like a, in my opinion, a very rigid way of being orthodox. So actually, recently I came to realize that this word heterodox, that sometimes it's used, is not the opposite of being orthodox. The opposite of orthodox is heretic. So heterodox will be like an alternative way of being orthodox, like not forgetting our roots, and on the foundation of those roots we have embracing a progressive and alternative, a new way of being a person, a lover of God and whatever. So thank you for that. And of course, I'm inviting you because I also acknowledge you as someone who embraces that paradigm. So welcome. And as with all of us, I'm thinking that, of course, we have all so many facets in our individuality, in our personality, in who we are, in how we serve. In your particular case, Bali, I don't know, we could say, and I don't want to label you, you tell me if I'm over-labeling you, but of course, you're a Vaishnav, you're a lyricist, you're a multi-instrumentalist, you are an author, you are a father, and so much more, of course. But if you are willing, we can explore some of those facets of the jewel of your identity, so to say, from the beginning. As you just mentioned, you were born in a Vaishnav family, you've gone through Gurukul, so I don't know, I'm interested in hearing from you, because I've not had that experience in this lifetime at least, so I'm interested in hearing from your personal perspective, which for you are like the pros, maybe cons, I don't know, of being born and raised in a specific religious movement, so to say, and how you eventually dealt with the encounter with the outside, quote unquote, or the world beyond your religious tradition.
Yeah, I was born to devotee parents who immigrated from Colombia. We grew up in the United States, and we had a very, in a certain way, ISKCON upbringing, you know, going to the temple. My brother and I, Kishore, we didn't go to Gurukul, meaning like a sleep-in ashram, until we were a little older. I was 14, we were 13 and 14. So I think that for our generation, it's born in the 80s, many people were sent in a little bit earlier. So in that sense, we went to the day schools. You know, they were schools that were run by devotees with a devotee curriculum. You know, our first like attendance for school was taken at the morning program, you know, at Guru Puja at 7:20 in the morning. And we attended part of Bhagavatam class, and we'd go and learn shloka memorization and Gita and do the plays and the drama. So very much like Krishna and being a devotee. And the identity of being a devotee, all of the cultural, traditional, or like ethnic practices of being like this hybridized Western, Eastern, you know, this like melting pot of what ISKCON is, or at least looked like back then. In that sense, we share that with many, many people from our generation. Then we went to Mayapur Gurukul in 99. So we were a little bit older, we were teenagers, went for 2 years, and then came back and jumped into the public school system back into the West. And then went to college, got a regular education. You know, we lived a sheltered life. Like, I can say that I lived quite a protected life. I remember when in the like mid-late 90s, when the Gurukul system kind of shut down in the States because of the lawsuits and all of the things that had happened. Many of us had to just go to school, like regular public school. And I was around 13 at the time. And the impressions are so... trauma is like a strong word, but they were so impactful. Like they're like these samskaras of kind of like entering into the material world, what a material public school is for somebody who grew up in a, you know, like a devotee home. And we weren't even so conservative, you know. Like my dad and mom, they gave us a Nintendo for Christmas, you know. We played for our local soccer league. We went to the movies, you know, like we listened to music, and that was, you know, whatever. Like, I remember we'd listen to Bob Marley and Carlos Santana on the way to the beach. Like, we lived like a very kind of what we would call a balanced life, where, you know, they're like, okay, you can listen to that music, but we have to do some kirtan first, or go change the water to the deities, you know, put a flower there, offer some incense, and then you can play. And then when we play, we'd just play like normal children, you know. We'd just play sports and games and Ninja Turtles and all that stuff. So we weren't so conservative, like in this sheltered bubble. We knew what was going on in the outside world to a certain extent, but then being kind of dropped into it, I just remember so many things. And I was still, you know, being 13, you're still completely in a child's body. But in the West, you know, there is no innocence, you know, like that innocence that you have, whatever the permission you're granted to have the innocence of a child, it ends quite early in the like public school system. So kind of seeing the heaviness of basically the material energy, if you want to call it that, was intense. And pretty soon after that, my parents were like, this is not for you, this is not for us, you're going to Gurukul, we're sending you to Mayapur. And we went to the ashram. And yeah, I think being protected, it kind of like allowed us to be innocent for a long time, which is, you know, like all of the experimentation and all of the things that happen in the psyche of like those formative years, they're fine and they're natural, but in time, at the right time, you know, when you're being exposed to certain things or certain ideas, concepts, or even just behaviors, like all of that, it's normal. This is the life experience. But just kind of like, you should be in an adult body if you're making adult decisions, you know, that kind of thing. So we were protected, and I think it went a long way in sheltering our bhakti. Because if we believe that purity is kind of a conduit for spiritual strength, then innocence, being innocent and being able to maintain, even through happenstance, being able to maintain some sort of integrity just because of the environment you grew up in, it allowed us to, I think, stay a little bit fixed. And it's just like Krishna is everything, you know, and we also, the philosophical foundation that we had, now me being a parent, I have my daughter's 5, she'll be 6 in March in just 2 or 3 months. And I think, like, when I was that age, the level of philosophy that we had, you know, the amount of, like, how we spoke about death, like, at that age, I was already not afraid of death. Like, it was not a part of my, like, there was no question, you know, this is as the embodied soul continuously, I already knew that verse. It was like embedded into my psyche. Like, you're going to let, this body is changing and growing. You're going to let it go when you die and you'll get a new one. Like, the soul is eternal. You actually will never die. I had that at that age. And now her, she's just, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, like, it was so, so different for us then, you know, like, she'll ask us questions and I'm trying to, like, baby her through these concepts of these, like, you know, what's going to happen to you, what's going to happen to me. And when I was that age, it was like, you've had a million mothers and fathers, you know what I'm saying? I love you and you're going to be okay. When it's your time, it's your time. When it's my time, but there's nothing to fear. It's totally normal. And, you know, it gave us a little bit of this, like, spiritual spine. And Krishna was everything. We had, like, faith, like, when bad things would happen, it was just like, this is karma. This is just my karma, or this is their karma, like tragedies, disasters, personal difficulties from a small age, that was just so embedded in my life, that and the belief in that was so strong.
Bali, and will you see all this last thing you mentioned as a pro or as a con, in terms of, you had a philosophy, you have a way of seeing, but sometimes some of these concepts can also take one to be a little bit indifferent to human emotion or experience. Oh, that's your karma, or yeah, you are my mom, but one among millions. So I'm curious about how it was for you navigating those concepts, received those concepts as a child, and maybe as you grew up, the theory is there, but you feel that you need to internalize that in a more human place, especially, I don't know, or maybe now as a father, as you say, how do you convey that to your children?
I think I had a unique situation in that I had all of these kind of like philosophical principles, but I also had very, very affectionate, loving parents. There was never any sense of, like, I was, you know, like, that philosophy was there, but it wasn't like my parents were like, hey, this is just like a passing transaction, because, like, my goal is to, you know, get liberation and you're not my child. You know, the things were, they were told to us, but with the bubble that I lived in, and I think we had many unique things, but the bubble that I lived in was, my parents were very affectionate and very loved. There was never a question. Like, it was, like, you know, like, we grew up, it's a Latin family, you know, we're from Colombia, and so it was full, all of the emotion that exists in these cultures, it was fully there. You know, we were embraced and sheltered by that. So I think, you know, my lack of empathy that I have is my fault. It has nothing to do with my upbringing. I, you know, whatever, like, you know, emotional shortcomings I have, I think they're more from just what is inside me than that. Because I really had, when I say balanced, it was balanced in that way.
Right. Great. Yeah, that's a beautiful combination. And in connection to your upbringing, Bali, I'm wondering, because I've talked with many second generation devotees born in a Vaishnava family going to Gurukul, or not going to Gurukul, but somehow being born in Gaudiya Vaishnavism as their, so to say, family religion, is, if you will. And many of them telling me, like, I remember talking to Namrasa Prabhu, and he told me, well, I was born in the religion. So in one sense, I didn't have to choose my religion. But at one point of my life, in his particular case, he told me, I had to choose whether voluntarily, do I want to make this my path, or I'm just carrying it with a social religious momentum that came from my parents. So I'm wondering in your case if there was or is or maybe will be or not at all a time when you feel like a more official moment of you choosing that, or if that happened, how it took place.
I think that I choose it every day, and I think I now, so I'm 40 now, and I think that I'm choosing it now more than I've ever had to choose it. Growing up, and in retrospect and currently, I just feel that there is no substitute or alternative that offers the fullness that I find here. The wholeness on many dimensions, you know, like the Vedanta, you know, it just is so complete. And there's, so your options are, okay, this religious path, then other religious paths, or no religious path. That's like your thing. So the other religious traditions, I have so much respect for them, and I truly believe that the people who they're looking for God on these paths will find God at the end of their lives. I don't know how that looks. I don't want to pretend that, you know, a devout, pure Christian goes to Krishna. I don't, or goes to Jesus. I don't know, you know. And I don't want to speculate either. I believe that they will find God in some way or form at the end of their life. If they love and they want that union, they will. But those traditions, they leave for me a lot to be desired. Philosophically, sometimes there's just certain things, and they can even be a handful of points that it's just like, you know, our tradition just takes care of that in such a nice, neat little package. And I find that if I were to ever pursue that, it would just, those questions or those doubts or this, like, you know, this point is just like, I just don't accept that. That would be an obstacle for me to ever fully embed or invest my faith in any other tradition. So then it's like, okay, then the other option is have no spirituality or no religion or no anything. And that, I find it, I find it dissatisfying. I received my doctorate in pharmacy. So like I fully went down a hard science route of education. And those years were very difficult to me because it's such a mechanistic, reductionist way of viewing the world. Everything from like the first class that you take all the way for those years, it's so rooted in just physics, biology, and chemistry. And everything is physics, biology, and chemistry. And then anything that you can't touch, it's just psychology, which at the end boils down to the chemistries. And you know, like there's no space or room for any type of metaphysical anything. And that was very difficult for me. That was a strong kind of changing point in my life to go from fully, everything is in the context of spirit or God or spirituality, to everything is in the context of matter, science, you know, like there's a cause and effect. And, you know, that there's a tension there because I also have a bit of like a critical mind. And I like, whenever someone would say something, they're like, oh, this beautiful like Leela happened, like this one devotee in Croatia had this experience. And my first thing is like, I'll immediately start to like come up with my questions. Like, oh, did they really, you know, see the deed? Did the movie, Didi really move? Did whatever it is. I always like, I have that kind of doubting, skeptical mindset. So being immersed in this like science culture, it was difficult for me because it makes you question everything, what, you know, that which can't be measured and can't be seen. And it was a few years of that because the program was like minimal 6 years, but there was travel in there. So like I stretched it out over like 8 years, and just being in that was hard. And then at the end, I just decided like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I don't want to think of the world in this way. Even if my first instinct is to kind of like break everything down into its material components and like deny the spiritual experience, that's my instinct. I have like this, like fault finder, they call that it, type personality. And I realized that the impulses to be atheistic, they're there, just like the impulses. I have so many impulses. You know, there's a chocolate bar here. Mm-hmm. And my impulse is to see.
You can eat it whenever you want, no problem, Bali. I'll give you permission.
And we'll edit that in post.
Edit the recording later, no problem.
We'll edit it in post. So like the impulse is there, and then I have so many impulses, and that's one of them. One of the impulses is just to kind of break things down into matter, chemistry, physics, and psychology, and anthropology, and all of that. You know. And I just like, I don't want to do that anymore. I mean, the impulse is going to come, but I don't want to feed that. I don't want to follow that path because it's dissatisfying. I went to this one lecture. They had some hybrid, like Bhaktivedanta Institute science type seminar in Gainesville with scientists and spiritualists. And it was really nice. And I think the mayor or somebody, some kind of politician or, you know, member of the whatever board came and he wasn't a scientist or anything, but he just said, you know, like, I choose to be faithful every day. Like I have two paths ahead of me, and one is down this like science path and one is down this faith path. And I just choose faith. And I was like, I like that. You know, I can go that way. I can easily go. I can follow that train all the way to the end of the destination and just say to my kids, hey, you know, some people believe this, and, you know, we respect and honor the traditions and all that stuff, and that these things are important. Kind of like religion is good for humanity, so we kind of do it to play the part. I'm like, I don't want to do that. I could do that, but I don't want to. I find it dissatisfying. I find it disingenuous a little bit too, because there's something out there, you know, there's something out there. And for me to think, you know, like there's no absolute reality or there's no absolute truth. And it's like, well, you just made an absolute statement. Mm-hmm. So you're saying there's no absolutes, but that statement in and of itself is an absolute statement. And I've also had experiences that I don't necessarily deserve or haven't earned, or maybe those years that I had when I was young, they've like stockpiled in the bank something within me that from time to time, like I can, without my intention, I'm able to withdraw something, or like it's like an interest, you know, I get the deposit of an interest of something that it's kind of like, there's something out here, you know, Krishna's here. You can't see it, but you know, you should realize that that's because of you. It's not because of God. Like the things that are impeding that vision and that understanding, they're my shortcomings. And so it's like, now I just got to kind of assess and address those. And then if I do it, because I'm not doing it right now, you know, I'm not. And especially not compared to what I was doing when I was younger, like doing the work or whatever. It's like, I'm not really doing the work. You know, I know what it's like to work hard at anything. And the amount of dedication, like when I had to get my degree, I was always working. Mm-hmm. I felt that like I'd give myself little breaks to just decompress, but pretty much I was always working at it. And then I got it at the end. but it was like, if I hadn't have worked that hard, mm-hmm. probably wouldn't have got it. You know, I would have kicking and screaming, been dragged and beaten and bruised and bloody, and maybe I would have got it. But in my spirituality, I know what it's like to work hard. And I see a lot of people that do work hard are doing the work. Then you're like, oh yeah, that's why they're glowing. Mm. That's why when I look at this person and they speak, it goes directly into my soul and it moves me, is because they're doing the work. Mm. So I have these, which is why I think it's so important. Like, what the guru means to somebody is just, you see somebody that's doing the work and it emanates from them. That's your guru. And then they're moving you and changing you through just their presence or through their words. And they might be saying the same things you've heard 1,000 times, but it's because the work that they've done in the background.
Yeah, like this expression, self-effulgent, right? It doesn't necessarily mean someone coming floating from the air, but just they emanate a certain light and you can see them by their own light, so to say, right? Like the sun, you can see the sun by the sun's own light, so... I really appreciate what you just say, especially stick in my mind the very first line you say in reply to my last question, which was that you choose this path every day and now more than ever. For me, that sounds like a perfect combination, that the choice is daily. It's not that I chose one when I got initiated, when I whatever, but the notion even of, as I like to speak, of renewing my vows. No, I mean, I may have officially received, accepted the vow of sannyas in my case one day 16 years ago, but the vow is to be renewed, rechosen on a daily basis. What does it mean for me to be sannyasi? What does it mean for me to be a Vaishnav? So I really appreciate the ongoing nature of the choice. Again, it's a daily choosing. In connection to, of course, to your Vaishnav lineage, our Vaishnav lineage. I remember recently you shared some posts. I generally don't check anyone's posts, but sometimes I check the general feed in Facebook and I came up on something you mentioned to the effect of that we come from a line of poets, we Vaishnavs come from a line of poets and dancers, divine artists, each of everyone. So I really appreciated that because I personally feel sometimes we lose sight with that particular side of our tradition, which is not just a side for me, but it's the very essence, a side which is so artistic, aesthetic, mystical, poetic. And sometimes, how to say, all that gets flattened and overtly packaged or overtly institutionalized. How to say, I'm wondering what do you think about what gets lost there? Now, when a mystical, deep, ancient artistic, poetic, aesthetic tradition gets to label too much, put in a particular box, in a particular formula, particular packaging. What gets lost there, and how art, which of course you are an artist, how does art help to keep a lineage like ours or any lineage alive rather than merely preserved, so to say? If you have any thoughts on it.
I think that this kind of very emotive, emotional, artistic side of spirituality, like you said, it's core to our identity. You know, all of, you know, Mahaprabhu, you know, the emperor of dance.
Yes, I like to say that movement began with movement. With dance,
yeah,
something moving inside, moving outside, and everyone was moved by that movement, and the whole thing started to move, literally.
And Srila Prabhupada, you know, was an artist. He sang, he was a multi-instrumentalist, he was a songwriter and lyricist and poet. These are not opinions, they're facts, it's out there. He was a writer, you know, these are the art forms that, you know, like the liberal arts and sciences, as they say in the academic world. I think that that kind of side of humanity, it can be used to mask integrity and sincerity, and so it's not valued. You know, it's like kind of like if you're an actor, you can cry really well for God. You know, whereas somebody who's not an actor, who has not an acting bone in their body, if they're weeping because of something, you know it comes from the integrity of their path.
Yeah, yeah. And Mahaprabhu himself received criticism at his time, like, you are a sentimentalist, how you dare as a sannyasi to dance and cry, that's emotionalism, so...
Mm-hmm. Why did Mahaprabhu go from, you know, this very, like, basically bohemian spiritual movement to then this, like, very rigid lineage? Like, there's got to be a reason, you know, behind that. And it's kind of like to offer validity to reality. The reality is, yeah, you know, it's like, what does it mean to love God? It's like, it's such a heart-based statement even to say. So it's like, but to make it real, we got to align it. It's like the heart has to be in alignment with the brain and the mind and the logic. So it's like you have your artsy dancing, and then you have your, like, sastric, like, rigidity, the orthodoxy. And you need both. Because if you have just an orthodoxy without softness, then you just get, like, automatons, like robots that are kind of just like following. And if you get a bunch of people who are just like whipped back and forth and driven by their emotional impulses, or even spiritual impulses, it's like, you know, like these babajis, like, who are just like intoxicated with love, this really good for you, but that's not gonna, like, it's not gonna,
it's not intelligent.
You need some rigidity to get it out there.
Yeah.
How are we going to follow, you know, it requires a printing press and logic and campaigns. Like, what Prabhupada did was a whole, like, campaign. I'm going to bring this Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition to the world. You can't just be, like, drunk in love with God in a garden somewhere, mm-hmm. and get that done. So it's like the heart and the mind, both.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the word articulation comes to my mind, right? How to articulate these profound ecstatic experiences into something that is relatable to those who are not that drunk and that mad, but they can, yeah, make sense of that and incorporate them into their lives. So that's a really, for me, that's a pressing question that should be an ongoing one, as you mentioned. Like, okay, our movement began with poets, with artists, and should continue so. But which are the reasons that sometimes make us feel a little bit like raise our eyebrows when, and there are reasons for raising our eyebrows, as we say. Mahaprabhu was criticized by that. Today, the day we are recording the episode, is the anniversary of Sri Chaitanya's sannyas lila. So also we could say he took sannyas, many reasons for his sannyas, but one of those was to bring some more gravitas to what he was trying to convey and articulate that, okay, sannyasi, social figure of a teacher. Before that, it's still as a sannyas, he was criticized, but in many ways the sannyas of Mahaprabhu could be seen as a social strategy, considering time, place, of circumstance, so for people to take him more seriously and see, I'm not just a sentimentalist crying and dancing, but there's something deep and serious going on here. But still, for me, it's an interesting question to continue asking, yeah, why sometimes we... not only raise eyebrows for the proper reason, but sometimes raise eyebrows not for the proper reason and became too entangled into the rigidity of a particular institutional religious box and somehow prevent the flow of natural artistry in everyone. Because as you say, ultimately everyone is an artist in one way or another, and I personally feel we should encourage that in whatever way that takes. I'm recently reading a book, you may be interested in that one. This actually, he's a scholar from the Old Testament. Here I have it. It's called The Prophetic Imagination. Walter Brueggemann is the author. And it's an academic book, but it's quite readable. And he's speaking there about the prophet. He used the word a lot, prophet, which is very present in Christian lingo. But prophet basically means someone who speaks for God, not someone who is... through whose speech the divine is manifested to. He says that the prophet makes it possible to sing. We are talking about you as a musician, as a kirtaniya, and all of us as potential artists. The prophet makes it possible to sing, and if a lack of singing is an index of exile, then we are in it, he will say, because for most of us people, he's speaking for most of people, most of us are people who can scarcely sing. And the prophet makes the hopefulness of singing happen again. So it was an interesting statement. And again, I cannot avoid reading these lines in connection to me being a Gaudiya Vaishnava and Mahaprabhu and the Sankirtan movement. So in light of what he just said, no, the necessity for singing is something that gives hope, and the opposite of not being able to sing as a symptom of exile, basically. In that sense, as a musician, as an artist yourself, do you see music, and especially devotional music, not just as artistic expression, but as an act of hope to other people, to yourself, like singing? Especially in the times in the world in general, which often feels like exile is present in so many ways in society. So I don't know, I'm wondering, what does it mean to help people recovering the capacity to sing again? Literally or metaphorically, to have hope and life is meant to be sing, to me, it's meant for singing. Just look at the birds, they are singing all day. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, a lot of times when we're doing our kirtan presentations, we have like a little thing, because we sometimes people have never been in a kirtan, so we have to contextualize it. And, you know, singing is basically, it's like the soul, it's its way of communicating. It's like, how do you cry or declare things in a more pure way from this body? You have this instrument that's embedded inside you, you know, with this resonating chamber and the vibrating cords. It's given to us. And every tradition that has existed and every, you know, era of humanity has some form of singing, specifically spiritual singing, because, I mean, we can talk about singing in the context of music, but since we're, you know, a little bit more angling towards the spiritual, it's like there's, whether you have indigenous tribes that are, you know, nomadic or in their settlements, whether it's in the indigenous tribes of Australia or the Americas, whether you're at a gospel, you know, Black Baptist church in the South or in a Gothic cathedral in Europe, you have some form of singing for spiritual union, for people that are using their voices to try and commune with the divine. There's a certain power in singing on its own, and when it's combined with that like higher principle or some form of longing, it just alchemizes within the heart to create transformation and an experiential, like, it's like the honey jar. It's like, if you want to, you're looking at the honey jar, you're looking at the honey inside the jar, and it's like, which for us, if we're saying the honey inside of the jar is God or love for God, it's like, if you want to taste it, try this. Because there's no, we could break it down as to how and why, but it's really something that has to be felt. You know, it's like when somebody, before I was a parent, and they would say like what the experience of parenthood is like and what the love that you would have for your child, you're like, oh, I get it. I totally, you know, I understand, of course. But it cannot be, it has to be experienced. That thing can only be when you're holding your child and it's like, oh my gosh, this is my son, this is my daughter.
And I was planning to go there in a moment also. What it means for you to be a father, yeah.
Yeah, it has to be felt. And so I think with, you know, music is so integral to the human experience. And it's just, you know, the rhythm and melody. They're just, it's, you don't have to teach it. It's like a child. You can see it. The moment they hear music, something happens. They move like inside of our little, whatever this vehicle is, this like the biology, the psychology, music has its effect. It moves, it changes, it stirs things within. And then, and I also think that this, like spirituality is also intrinsic, you know, the questions and the seeking and this like sense of even nowadays where it's very popular for people to say like the universe, like, oh, the universe. And it's a little bit a way of kind of like, they're like, I don't want to say the word God and I don't know if I believe in God. But there's like, I acknowledge that there is something greater than myself. That for me is like the seed or the root of spirituality. It's like, I acknowledge that there is something. I don't know what it is. I don't know if I even accept that, you know, that there is, but I acknowledge that it's there.
Yeah.
And so when you have these two kind of intrinsic principles, they mix in a certain way and create a very lasting and powerful impression. And I think that specifically why in this age, like the modern age or Kali, it's like the why Kirtan is so prominent is because specifically now, like it, out of all of the unions of the human experience and spirituality, which can get you up there to like whatever divine ecstasy, this is the one, these are the two compounds that together create the most powerful reaction, which is Kirtan, which is basically singing for the divine.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I'm reflecting about, yeah, how men, I can see how much more and more people, of course, they are looking. I mean, we are living in an age where there is such a big crisis of meaning and purpose. And so many youth, is people in general, but youth in particular, also are going back to exploring spirituality in one way or another, like from that crisis of meaning and purpose. And but also they are looking for something experiential. I mean, of course, theory is there. The dogma, the teaching is there, but if it doesn't take you to a particular undeniable experience, it's not enough for them, and that's great. You need an experience. So I'm thinking how Kirtan conveys that. Of course, there is a philosophy to Kirtan, and you can explain sound and so many things in so many ways, but at the end of the day, you need, as Krishna says in the Gita, Pratyaksha Bhagavam, this understood by experience at the end of the day. But I'm thinking even at when the time comes to explaining it, as you were mentioning, even for people who wouldn't like to speak about God, okay, the universe or this or that, I'm just about matter, and you were explaining your experience with science. Even through science, we can take advantage, so to say, from so many insights they are bringing in terms of, they will say, okay, everything in the world is having a particular frequency and a particular vibration. So you can start to mention how everything is singing and dancing. If you want to become a little more poetic, every atom is singing and dancing in its own frequency and vibration. So again, that's why it's natural. Rhythm and melody and dance and music and conceive all these practices in this way. And thinking about Kirtan also, that you just referred to briefly, also the communion part of Kirtan, which we'll call San Kirtan. So Kirtan is not something that just, it's not just performance, but it's something that happens between people. It's kind of a social phenomenon. Sometimes I like to make a play of words that by myself I can bring, take a pair of kartals and do some Kirtan. But to do some Kirtan, we need each other. So to say, not to downplay picking a pair of kartals and singing to God. But when we are in community, so to say, with other people, that creates an alchemy that cannot be found by oneself. So I like to ask you, I mean, you've spent literally thousands of hours and days and weeks immersed in the experience of Kirtan. So how do you experience Kirtan as a relational space? No? Where actually, at times you are listening, at times you are leading the Kirtan, at times you are following someone, depending if you are playing an instrument or singing. So there are all these different roles in the relational space of Kirtan. So if you could share some reflections on that.
Yeah. There's kind of two, I'd like to speak about two different principles of Kirtan, which one is that when you're with peers, the Kirtan will lift you higher than the sum of your parts. So, you know, like, say if we wanted to quantify people's spiritual depth and understanding and integrity, and you have, you know, 5 points and this person has 7 points, when you get together, something happens in the moment where the thing provides 3,000 points, and the sum of your guys' spiritual integrity is only 320. So how did something happens that it's like, oh, it's taking us to a place that we are not at individually, but somehow when we're doing it collectively, we rise, yeah, higher than the total sum of our spiritual understanding. And I why that happens, maybe there's some either science there, or there's some scriptural type of evidence as to how it brings you, to a higher level than you would achieve. One, than you would achieve alone, but even that two individuals would achieve alone in summation, still it goes higher. Mm-hmm. I don't really have an answer for that, but that's my experience. My experience is you can have two people who are kind of trying, and maybe most of their life is quite mundane and centered on just doing the regular things of life. And then in that moment, when they sing together, suddenly something happens and they become like divinely enthused and infused to be pure and empowered. And then the moment that it ends, it's like, I'm just a human. I'm a deeply flawed human being who has impulses and behaviors and all of these things that are contaminated by the material sphere. But something happens when we sing together that it's like, I'm a divine being. I am divine and I'm perfected. And in this moment, and sometimes it's just like, it can literally be one instant. It's like, for this instant, I am fully realized. This person is fully realized. We're all there. And then, and maybe it can sustain.
Sorry, you're having a trailer of eternity, as I like to say it.
Yeah, exactly. You're getting a preview. I think like those drops of grace I was talking about that I've gotten in my life. It's kind of like you get that. And I don't necessarily know that I have an answer as to that. I think I have that observation. And I think another aspect is when there's somebody who is particularly empowered or invested in kirtan or in God, in their spiritual path, they can ignite a situation to bring people beyond what they would do on their own. So you can have everyone, like you just call them like whatever, like fungus, the bottom layer spiritually. And then you have one being, if you want to call them enlightened, or maybe not even enlightened, but empowered through their investment in chanting. And they'll transform those people in that moment. It's like kind of like a rising tide, but one individual or a group of individuals, if it's not always one, can actually just lift. And then all the ships that are there, they all get risen up just by the power of one person or of three or four or five people. And in that moment, everybody there becomes supercharged with spiritual energy. And I don't have an answer. I'm sure that there's evidence somewhere and something says somewhere and something, but for me, that's kirtan's power. The ability to lift higher than would be lifted or attained by any mortal means is able to be done in kirtan, and sometimes like done quite easily.
Something that comes to my mind, and I don't mean to sound like now I'm offering you the answer to the thing that you didn't have an answer to. I'm just thinking along with you. And what came to me when you were saying, okay, why this is happening? And it's not that we want to reduce the experience to an explanation, but I think there is a beauty in exploring that. What came to me is like, okay, we are all relational beings in one sense. We all exist in connection to one another with a common center. We would call it Krishna, okay, the all-attractive center, and everything else in reality is like orbiting around that center. So kirtan is like an embodied affirmation of that. Like we sit around the center of Krishna, around the name of Krishna, the sound representing that center, and everyone singing along, like orbiting around that center. So it's a way like enacting what already is going on, but if we don't live as if that's the case, we don't have the experience. So when we intentionally sit, acknowledge a common center, invoke that common center, and engage in Sankirtan in relation to each other is kind of a way of bringing to our, not only memory, but experience, we are all one family, we are all interconnected, we have a common center, and that brings an experience. So that's what I was thinking now, and that's what it makes me think of so many sections in scripture, like, I don't know, that also kirtan, of course, it's chanting and singing, but also in our tradition, kirtan could be seen as speaking about God, not like Sukadev Goswami is described as the kirtan, these nine methods of Bhakti, Shravan, Kirtan, Vishnu, Shravan, and Rupa Goswami say the main reference point for kirtan is Sukadev Goswami, and he's not so much well known as playing Mridang or harmonium, but speaking the Bhagavatam, so, which is a way of praising, basically. And then the Gita in the 10th chapter, 9th verse, speaks about how devotees share with each other their hearts, speaking about Krishna, and they, again, are raised to another level by their sharing, nourish each other, enlightening one another. So I'm relating to these verses, which do not necessarily may relate to picking the harmonium, the mridanga, but speaking about Krishna, but that same thing is kirtan, that same thing applies to the chanting. And I really like what you mentioned also, I really appreciate that these two varieties of getting together with peers from a sincere place and all of you raising to a particular level of experience that is bigger than where you are as individuals, or having a particular, as you say, empowered 1, 2, 3, 4 people that somehow pervade the whole audience to be there as well. And it makes me think of this, a statement by Rupa Goswami. He says that three qualities of sadhu sangha, swajatiya, snigdasya, and swatabara, with like-minded people, with affectionate people. And then he says swatabara, which many times is translated as with higher people. But for me, and I've heard that from other practitioners, this higher people can mean with someone who is clearly higher or more empowered, like going to your example of someone empowering everyone else and raising everyone to another level, or associate with like-minded people that are maybe all peers, but if we get together from a sincere place, our sincerity will take us to an experience that is higher. We feel a higher current descending, even if we are all peers. So, yeah, I couldn't avoid relating all that stuff to what you were saying.
Yeah, I think that I've been to other experiences where people come together with intention to, for example, have japa type workshops, seminars, or somebody like a guest speaker is doing, like, I'm doing the Uddhava Gita and we're all going to study. And that intention, definitely you can feel the consciousness and their energy become raised because it's a group of people. I feel that I reflect that is correct, that the collective intention does create a specific energy. I just think kirtan is like plugging directly into the outlet.
Live wire, yeah. Well, we can go into so many directions. So you play so many instruments. We can have a separate podcast of you and play mridanga, esrach, and so much stuff. But let's go for a moment, because, of course, you are kirtaniya. You have studied Indian classical music, but you are also a lyricist, and in this context, a hip-hop artist, if I'm not mistaken. You please correct me if I'm wrong. So I'd like to go there for a moment, because I really find it a very interesting side of the equation, me being a musician myself. And I've heard some hip-hop in my teenage years. I remember Cypress Hill was one of those bands. But I'm thinking mostly about hip-hop. As you may know, hip-hop, in this case, was born as protest, as a way of to reclaim voice, to reclaim dignity, to reclaim power from the margins. So as a Vaishnav and a hip-hop artist, how do you see protest functioning in a redeeming way today? And if so, in which way?
Yeah. hip-hop as an art form, like you said, it came as a form of protest. I would say, to go even further or deeper, that it comes from a place of pain.
I was going to go there in a minute. Behind every protest, there is some collective lament or lamentation, right?
Yeah, and so it and that pain in the human experience, it creates an edge, you know, like. There's fun, you know. Hip hop can be fun and it can be lyrical and it can be so many things. But I think if we boil down why it's so powerful, is it's such a candid dialogue, or I guess monologue, of the human condition, what that person is going through, and a lot of what it sprung from. Was places of pain, you know, like, you know, these people that are, you know, marginalized or dispossessed, or, and then the lives that they're forced to live because of circumstance. Mm-hmm. And then they're sharing in, like, in an art form that is so, there's no art form musically that is better suited for candid, frank conversation than hip-hop. You have so much music and you can say so many words. You can sometimes, I'll look at my songs and the amount of lyrics, when you take like a general, like a pop song or a rock song, and you have your verse hook, you might have like 60 words in a whole, like a classic. They'll be like, oh, in a classic, and then like one verse might have three times that, and I have three verses and the hook. It's so much, because the spoken word to rhythm at a certain BPM, you can express a lot of ideas, you can tell a lot of stories. And I think that, you know, and for me, I think it is important to acknowledge that I'm making hip hop music, and to acknowledge its roots, because that's kind of what guards one against like appropriating another person's culture, another people's culture and tradition. You know, this is Black America. Mm-hmm. And what we have to acknowledge, where it came from. And even, you know, I think when I write, I can't relate to that marginalized position that they came from. You know, I grew up with, like, very humbly and very simply, like, we were in Section 8 housing, and, you know, on Medicaid and all of the stuff that, you know, we were low income and all that stuff. But, you know, I had two loving parents at home, you know, and I was not surrounded by crime and all of these other things. I led a good childhood, you know, but I have my pains. You know, I had difficult experiences. I lost my mother at a young age. I have my own, which a lot of the things that I write about are my own, like, who am I fighting against? I might not be fighting against the police who are trying to brutalize my people and my culture, but it's like I'm fighting against my impulses and my senses, which I feel brutalize my psyche. And so kind of like fighting back those things. And then, of course, you know, just having, I think, and especially to bridge it with our tradition, where you have this longing, like, I would really love to be in love with God, and like these things that are getting in the way, like I want to be connected, and I'm angry and I'm upset at like this prison that I have constructed because of my actions, my behaviors, my mindset. And so I grew up listening to hip hop music, and it's, you know, I don't know numbers, but it's definitely, if not the most, one of the most powerful cultural musical movements of human history. And so I listened to it with the same kind of, I guess, attachment that other people do, which is, you know, to the struggle, the journey, the reality, the candidness, the frankness of their experience. And then, of course, rhythm, which is, I'm a percussionist. Mm-hmm. It's rhythm and then lyricism, the way that people, the way that these artists are able to just make music with it's like, okay, well, this person can't sing that well, but the lyrical ability to create percussion and alliteration and rhyme is just as musically impressive as somebody who can, like, who's like, I got pipes like crazy and they can sing. So, so in that sense, yeah, I find it as an art form. It's amazing. It moves me. I still listen to it to this day. I have to be able to channel that. I got to immerse myself in it. And, yeah. And I think it's a powerful tool for revolution. Mm. It was a tool for revolution, many things. It has been kind of like the soundtrack for many changes in American history. And then internally for my own revolution, you know, because I can say the things that I feel, and if I say it enough, maybe it'll come true. You know, that's my kind of philosophy. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to break out of this prison that my mind has put me in, and I want to be in union with my creator. Like, and if I say it enough times, then it'll manifest.
I was thinking about, yeah, the word that came to me while you were explaining the uniqueness of hip hop was also the word confessional, right? This is quite confessional. It's very much entering a vulnerable space of nakedness, and again, stripped off instruments and things, and it's you with your story, with your honesty, and giving it a voice, basically. It can be can imagine connecting it with Kirtan in its own unique way, how empowering it can be, you know, like finding your voice, being able to articulate your story from a place of honesty. And as you said, and that I was about to tell, that even if hip hop have started as protest and related to protest, many times we hear the word anger. But generally, as one of my teachers will say, behind every expression of anger, there is an expression of sadness. There is some pain, there is some suffering, and it takes the form of anger. We are protesting about something that probably is breaking our hearts, right? So, and every generation, I'm thinking every generation, I mean, every individual, but even generationally, there is some specific things that we see, okay, we need to give voice to this, we need to protest about this. There's something that needs to be redeemed, basically. And therefore, first, that something needs to be named. Because if you don't give it voice, if you don't articulate, it's not existing. So I'm thinking, in your particular experiences as someone who is addressing hip-hop as an art form, as a confessional part, but in connection to the Gaudiya Vaishnava community, and in connection to hip-hop as a form of grieving, if we want to use that word, I'm really much into grieving, into the necessity of grieving as a form of emotional healing and expression. What are we, in your opinion, what are we not grieving enough today? Whether as a society at large, or maybe in the Gaudiya Vaishnava society, and how does that ungrieved loss or thing may distort our attempts at change, at reform, if something comes to your mind?
I think, I don't know where this quote comes from, but I know I heard it from Ayanja Prabhu. Mm-hmm. Cry, and if you can't cry, cry that you can't cry.
Bhaktisiddhanta Sarvaita Thakur said that, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, even Bhaktivedanta Thakur had a lot of poems, and there's like, one is like, I'm just so unworthy. Like, I'm lamenting at my lack of advancement on my spiritual path. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of lament and a lot of longing there. So, you know, if we could tap into that, if we could tap into that sense of like what it truly means to long for someone, I think that sometimes as a devotee, we're kind of, it's like, I'm chanting because this is good for me. I'm chanting because I'm trying to purify myself. Mm. Or I'm doing these things. And then it's like, are you in love with Krishna? Like, are you like, man, Radha Krishna, if the both of you could just put your hands on my head and just show me you're there. I just like, there's nothing more I've longed for in my life than that. And like that sense of like weeping for the fact that like, I would love to be held by you. That mood, I think that sometimes we don't allow ourselves that level of, I don't know if it's vulnerability or even it's like, that's the kind of thought that's so beyond me. I just need to first like realize I'm not this body, and I have to like get all of these like rudimentary fundamental principles of our tradition and of spirituality. Like, let me try and digest these, and then I can even think about, you know, this the next step. And I think that in our acharyas, they were at that next step. And I actually just finished Ayendra Prabhu's biography, and of course he was a huge influence in my life, and he's like on the shrine of my heart for teachers. But he was like, this is our tradition. Like this, like the depth, like this rag marg, like this is really the, like you, like we're all saying like, oh, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Mahaprabhu and all of these poets and all that stuff. Like that's them. Like I want to just be good enough to like serve them. And it's like, no, you should be saying what they're saying. This is your heritage. You are meant to be saying these things and longing for these things and working for these things. And he was so adamant about that, that people, they couldn't handle it. It was like, this is too deep. It's too advanced. And he was just like, are you trying to be in love with God? Or are you just trying to, like, what's your end goal here? And I think, you know, connecting that that soft, artistic, poetic lamentation and longing for union, that's what's missing. Mm. And I think that art helps us. It's like, you may not be there, but when you sing with your eyes closed and you're pouring it out, you're there. You may not be there, but you have arrived in that moment for that particular instance in time.
Yeah. And I was thinking, of course, it's such a delicate dance and navigation, because we can completely deny the whole thing. As you say, no, that's too high. That's Bhaktivinoda Thakur. That's Mahaprabhu. We are not that. And we can become evasive and lazy and not responsible enough to embrace our call. But also we can rush into that direction without having certain foundation in place, and that cannot be healthy as well. I've seen devotees trying to enter into a form of longing or imitating some of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's songs and becoming depressed, basically, like feeling miserable about themselves in a way that doesn't instill further love. So it's a very important way of how to not lose sight of what our path is actually about. As you were mentioning, quoting Ayendra Prabhu, yes, the goal of life is to fall in love passionately with the divine, with all that it entails, how to actually make it sure that we're walking in that direction, but also in a way that is realistic, sustainable, balanced, and we are not becoming, I don't know, dysfunctional or evasive in the name of the highest ideal, or in the name of not being a sahaja. We are not, repressing our growth and potential. So both things can happen. So yeah, it's such a delicate dance, but a necessary one for sure. Vali, I like to go for a moment, being mindful of our time. Still, we have a few more minutes, but I like to switch gears to one other of your, the size of your personality, which is you are an author. And if I'm not mistaken, a few years ago, three, 4 years ago, you've published your first book.
Yeah, I wrote a fiction fantasy piece.
So it's a word of fantasy you have, right? You describe yourself as a word of fantasy.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you something about that, because of course you are a writer of then fantasy or science fiction. I don't know if that's also a term you could identify with. And I'm relating this to the word imagination, which I will say imagination will be central to your craft as a writer of fantasy. So I'm curious how you understand the role of imagination in human life and spiritual life. Again, I've written this book called The Prophetic Imagination, which emphasizes a lot the meaningful, the importance of imagination, basically, how any meaningful change in our lives, in society, in the world at large, first must be imagined before it can be enacted, so to say. Now, because if we have lost our capacity to imagine that something could be possible, I cannot avoid having John Lennon's song in my head now, imagine this, imagine that. If we lose the capacity to imagine, then we are disempowered and will be only able to implement whatever is already given as the norm, so to say. And there's one line, probably the most impactful line from this book, from Walter Brueggemann. He said that our modern culture is competent to implement almost anything and to imagine almost nothing. And on top of that, sometimes in spiritual circles, the word imagination is often dismissed as mere mental speculation, so to say, right? So you cannot imagine, take things as they are, this is the revelation, fall the path. So I guess my question to you will be, how do you see the difference between imagination as a generative, hope-giving, empowering capacity versus imagination as something that can become escapist or ungrounded? So what will a healthy, spiritually mature relationship with imagination look like?
It's interesting that you bring this up, because out of all of the things that all of my artistic pursuits, this is the one that is the only one that I have kind of completely detached from my spiritual path to a certain degree. You know, like I'm a musician, I play instruments, but I play instruments that are related to kirtan. I'm a hip hop artist and I write lyrics, but all my lyrics are grounded in my spiritual path. This particular avenue of my artistic expression is something that for me, I mean, maybe someone else could, you know, in an effort to uplift me, find a way to, like you're so good at kind of encouraging, to find a way to bridge it into some kind of like divine plan or purpose. I actually have my own opinions, at least as far as like imagination, fantasy, and a spiritual journey, because what many people think of my spiritual path is mythology and fantasy. You know, like I go to places and I have to tell people, like, you can't say that about Hanuman. You know, like, you can't say this mythological fantasy figure. I'm like, this is a being that I believe in. So, or, you know, all of these, it's like, oh, it happens all the time, this kind of language. And I'm like, so I have a bit of like a defensiveness over one, the topic, but also kind of like, even like, I don't read, I don't know how to say this, like, texts or books that are written inside of dharmic lineages. Like, if somebody's like, I've written this story of Balaram or Hanuman, or I'm like, it's too close. The lines become so blurred, because they're like, oh, this is, you know, Indra, and this is Zeus, and this is Thor. Mm-hmm. And for me, so I'm like, I don't even play. Like this, if I'm going to read about Indra, it's going to be in the context of my tradition, mm-hmm, and in the context of my faith. So I've kind of like divorced fantasy from my spiritual path, because people call my spiritual path fantasy. So I've had to be like, fantasy is fantasy. My spiritual tradition is an ancient religious practice that has existed for thousands of years. And there may be a lot of commonalities, and we can go on a whole discussion of that. So anyways, all that to kind of contextualize that when I write, you know, like, if you ask me about imagination or storytelling, for me, it's gonna talk about the human condition. Mm-hmm. Basically, like, what, you know, when you read something, or when I read, or when I was writing, I'm like, I want people to feel connected to these characters, that when this character feels, they're like, because the book that I wrote is a story. It's really about friendship. It's set to like an adventure, because I like to escape. Like, I enjoy escapism. I like watching film or reading something or watching something that I get to see some adventurous escapade. That's something that I enjoy. So the setting is that it's an adventure, and it's got swords and magic, but really it's about these kind of different people from the different little bit backgrounds. And they're all trying to protect one another, and they're all trying to help one another, and they're on this mission. And so it's like, at the end, what am I trying to do is like, this, you know, this is like the tagline for the book at the end was like, what would you do for your friend? Would you start a war? Would you kill a king? That's like on the back text, like, how far would you go? So, you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with my devotional path, but I would like a person reading it to think, to see something going on between two characters that are young and grew up with each other, and saying like, this is what it would be like to die for somebody, or to throw your life on the line for a person you grew up with, or this is what it was would it be like to feel like maybe you were falling in love with somebody, but you have to protect your brother, and that's more important right now. Mm. Something like that. So for me, that's very human. These people, there's no mention of spirituality. It doesn't even, like, there is, which is some, maybe its own commentary, but like, there's nobody in my book mentions faith or practices anything. There's no religious institution, which sometimes fantasy novels, they do that. Mm. I'm like, this is just a story about people. They're recovering from this war. They're trying to protect their friend, and let's have at it. Let's escape into this fantastical world with them. And if you like swords and like magic and like adventure and a little bit of intrigue, and there's a little bit of darkness in there with the villains, and there's family, like, you know, there's family trying to protect themselves, and there's a little bit of politics. That's it. So, you know, what the role is of storytelling and imagination for a person on a spiritual path, I think, to kind of come back and actually address the question that you had, I think that if you can't imagine, like if we're talking about Ayanjabaru, like if you can't imagine the goal, like being there, how will you even long for that? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and I'm speaking even for myself, who I don't necessarily know that I have an aspiration to like Ayanjabaru's aspiration, I don't know that that's mine. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, I want to assist Radha Krishna in their like conjugal pastimes in the groves of Vrindavan. I'm like, I don't know that, like, for sure it's amazing. I don't know if that's the end fiend for my life.
Maybe a long-term imagination, but there may be a middle-term imagination, something that still you can, in your case, no? Like, project
something long, something to long for.
Yeah.
And I think going back to why our tradition is so full and complete, is it's like, how do you want to see God? Because it exists. Do you want to see God as your friend? Do you want to see him as your lover? Do you want to just serve? Does the thought of just being bowed by the greatness of like your creator, your divine mother and father, is that what's works for you? Does like the negation of your entire identity, your immolation of yourself to merge into, like, I just want to be back. That it also exists there. And so it's like whatever way, whatever attracts you, whatever attracts your imagination, whatever you imagine, whatever you can imagine yourself being in your purest state, like that exists inside of this tradition. I think that that's why I just like it the best. And I think a role of imagination is like, okay, well, imagine that you had everything that you could possibly want in your spiritual journey. Now, like manifest that in your daily life. So if you want to serve like Hanuman serves Ram, like you got to imagine what that role and what those practices would look like.
Thank you, Bali. And regarding your writing project, I may sound like I will be contradicting you, but in a loving way, I wouldn't say that your writing project is entirely divorced from your spiritual practice. Even if you think so, or even if you try to, there is so much spirituality embedded in you that I'm sure that many of the things, at least for me, not to justify watching movies as my crucial sadhana, so to say, but one can watch a movie and that can be as impactful in terms of visuals and sound and emotions and one can be connected with so much depth of reality. And even if it's in terms of humanness, I always like to remind myself and others that, especially in our tradition, we worship Krishna, Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan, which is Nara Lila, human pastimes. So it's not inhuman, it's not non-human, it's very human, fully divine, but fully human. So I think there is a reason to see those things that are connected to our human dimension, whether it is family and friendship, as something that can play a role. Again, not to over-justify them and, okay, I'm stopping my chanting and reading, I'm just watching movies and got to go log through that sadhana. But I personally think there is place to connect those dots. And even you say, okay, my book is an adventure. Well, life is an adventure. So there's a lot of symbolic patterns. That's my opinion. I don't want to argue with
If
the
you
author
have
of
that
the book about
intent,
it, but I can see how there are so many things to connect it. So going to one final share question, Bali, because we talked about you being, again, Vaishnav musician, being born in a Vaishnav family, hip-hop artist, lyricist, author. I'd like to touch on another facet of your identity that feels just as formative, and we mentioned that, which is being a father. So I know, of course, this is only one of the many relational roles you inhabit. You are also a husband, you are a son, you are a friend, you are a brother, and so on. But this one I often ask to different people, not only guests in my podcast, since especially in my case as a swami, as a sannyasi, I don't have first-hand experience of what it means to be a biological father, though somehow I have children of my own in other ways, people to take care of. So, and you mentioned briefly, but a little bit more if you would like to share. So my question will be basically, and I ask this to many fathers and mothers, what changed most profoundly in you when you became a father? No, the before and after, as you hinted before. One is the theory, what you hear, and then the experiential exposure to holding your baby for the first time in your arms, for example. What came in that moment, basically?
I think that becoming a father, it showed me what devotion means. You know, I think we live our whole lives talking about devotion and devotional service. And then it wasn't until I became a father that I realized I'd never actually engaged in real, sincere, selfless devotion in my life. I've engaged in service, but I think that it became apparent that there is a motivation. Like I did, so if let's call kirtan the devotional service. I've done a lot of that over the years, but it's not selfless. I enjoy it. I've definitely done a lot of kirtan where I'm doing it for the, you know, taking one for the team, as they say, where it's like, you know, this is a distasteful maybe moment in my life, but I'm going to do it for the higher principle. But when you're a parent, it's like you're kind of doing that all day, every day, where you're totally negating your needs, your wants, and your preferences for someone else, and you do it with love. And I, you know, it was very apparent that I had not really experienced that in my entire life until having a child, where I was truly, I tell this story a lot, is when our kid came home from the hospital, my daughter, and she, you know, they, when babies are born, they have this like new skin, and then you have to like give them oil and help them get rid of that old skin as they're being exposed to air. So she was, you know, days old, and she's laying on the bed, and we have coconut oil, and I'm just rubbing her little feet, and their feet are like this big, and I'm just being so careful. And I was thinking, like, I feel, and I told this to Daniel, I was like, I feel like I'm worshiping a deity right now.
Yeah.
Like this level of care and tenderness, and just like, you know, what people who, you know, like say Ayendra Prabhu, who is like such a devotion towards his Shilas and his Murtis, where it's just like fully immersed in serving this being in front of me. And they're, and especially at that age, as they get older, there is some reciprocation. They're infusing with joy by their just being. But when they're that little, it's literally, she's just sleep. There's nothing. It's like Mahavishnu, just like sleeping, slumbering. And I'm serving your feet. And I just felt like, wow, I've never, you know, I feel like I'm doing like puja right now. It's like archanam. And if fully focused and with full heart and intention aligned right now. And so that was super transformative for me. And in general, just kind of like surrendering, that aspect of surrender, which we kind of fight that a lot as adults. And even when you have a partner, there's like some give and take, you know, you're both kind of compromising. When you're a parent, it's just you, like for a very long time. And when you go from not doing that to suddenly this is central to your every single day, where it's like, I'm serving, this person is more important. This thing that I'm doing right now is so much higher in a priority than my personal preference. And I'm going to just do it, and not just do it, but most of the time doing it with like a sincere adoration and affection and love. That was an entire transformation. And in that moment, out of all of the rasas, you know, I had never growing up, like Ladu Gopal and Baby Krishna, it had always been like, of course, like it's a very endearing, oh, you know, but there was no way for me to act. I was like, I can understand Arjuna and Hanuman, and I can even understand the gopis to a certain degree and the merging, that all makes sense. But the baby Krishna, like you're there and they're just goo goo gaga. And then I had a baby and I was like, oh, this is so pure. This love right now is so, and it's so untinged, because with the other things, you know, whether your friend can betray you and your brother can anger you and your spouse, like, that can hurt you worse than anyone else. And your child, it is pure love. It's just pure. They can do nothing. And all you can do is like shower them with love, and they're just kind of receiving it. And it's somehow still filling you. Mm. 10 out of 10. Would recommend the highest form of love that exists on the material.
So you've checked the Vatsalya box after that. That was amazing.
Yeah. After that, I was like, 100%, I get it. And still, you know, the Gopi Bhav is so beyond me. I'm like, Ayendra Prabhu, that's for you. I get this one more. I can understand this one a little bit more.
Thank you for that. And I really appreciate it, because, again, as you may have heard, sometimes, unfortunately, this idea of being a parent, having kids, sometimes it's mostly labeled as you're entangled and this is an obstacle, it's getting in the way and it's attachment. And I'm not saying all those things cannot happen, but also you can relate to all that as a sacred chapter of your sadhana, as you say, your babies, and is a deity, and you can really gain more affinity, and the whole Krishna reality of Krishna Lila can gain a whole lot more of relevance and relatability through the experiential exposure, and especially, as you say, the self-sacrifice of being a parent 24/7. And I always like to tell people, because most people will end up having kids, most in the sense of not probably the majority of society will be a monk. So, but I try to remind myself and those who would like to pursue monasticism, is like, well, you have to do it in a way that is sustainable and healthy for you, and that you can also express your own form of self-sacrifice in how a father is doing that for a child. Somehow, you don't have a child biologically, but somehow this is not an escape from self-sacrifice and absorption and care and dedication and adoration. It's not that we want to be brahmacharis or sannyasis so we don't have to go through that. It's just another way of going through that in your own way. So thank you for that reminder. Bali, before concluding, one more minute. Do you have 5 more minutes?
So I was going to tell you,
yeah, please.
You know, don't feel pressed for time. You know, I have, if you want to,
I
put an hour and a half because you said that, but
thank you, thank you. I think we are reaching a nice point to put the sharing to rest.
Good. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm happy to end whenever you're ready.
And we could continue. I don't see it as an end. It's an ongoing conversation. But to wrap up, I like to, and sometimes I invite some of my guests. In Sanskrit, we have this saying, Madhureena Samapayet, which is, let's end with something sweet. But also I added this, I switched that to Ushneena Samapayet, with ending with something sweet also, but spicy. So I'd like to present you a brief set of 10 brief spicy questions, and I expect a similarly short spicy answer from you. I know you can do it. So short answers, short questions, short answers, no thinking, not much thinking, just presence. Ready? Number one, Mridanga or Esrach? If one had to go silent forever.
Mridanga. I choose the mridanga to play.
Yeah.
That's my that's my weapon of choice for the rest of.
Okay. Number two. One word that you are tired of hearing in spiritual circles.
One word.
It can be two or three, no problem. It can be an expression. It can be a concept.
I think Carmies?
Yeah, why not? I
you know, like, to put contextualize, it's just basically the concept of us versus that, like, we are here,
yeah,
and those, they're non-devotees. We'll call it non-devotees, maybe, because that might, you know, that there's some kind of hierarchy that, you know, we're somehow better.
We are the chosen ones. Yeah, I subscribe to that fully.
Yeah.
Number three, where do you feel most at home? In sound, in silence, or in relationship? And you can pick more than one if you want.
Relationship.
What's
home? Easy.
Yeah.
The sound, this, yeah, it's not alone. Can't do it. Can't do it alone.
What's harder? Number four, what's harder? Staying faithful to tradition or staying honest with yourself?
Honest with yourself. Easy. I Vaisheshika Prabhu says integrity is what you do when nobody's watching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that, how to be real and to be in your own mind and alignment. That's a challenge.
Number five, if Kirtan could protest one thing today, what will it be? Mahaprabhu went to just, Kasi's place with his group to protest something also, right? So Kirtan can be a form of protest in a healthy way. So what will it be?
I think that the best thing to protest would be disunity. You know, like if we could find a way that Kirtan, it's like, hey, like we're all on the same side. Anybody who believes anything, if you acknowledge that there is a power that may be there, that's out there, that's higher than you, we're on the same team. Protesting for that would be.
What's one spiritual habit that can quietly become toxic?
The belief that you do things according to your nature, meaning like kind of like we have like a joke like that's not my seva, Prabhu, where it's like, you know, like I'm an artist, I'm a musician, so my seva is kirtan seva, or I'm a this. And kind of just that allows you to just selectively maneuver through life, not challenging yourself and just doing the things that are easy for you and according to your nature. And sometimes you have to challenge yourself. So that can easily be toxic.
Totally.
Just doing the comfortable, easy thing.
Yeah. Someone has to wash the pots.
Exactly.
Yeah. The seventh question will be, what softens you instantly?
An apology. A sincere apology.
What still scares you a little or more than a little?
Yeah, the safety of my children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had said how, you know, kind of one of the, talking about that principle of how children, they can actually enhance your spiritual journey. There's this, the fear. I'm like, I have this kind of like a contract between me and God, just keep them safe and me and you will be good.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, we're going to have problems. That hangs over me, you know, it's a danger.
And I've read and heard many times how many, the psychology of most parents is unavoidably like the worst possible thing can potentially happen to my children. So you are on alert mode, not hopefully neurotic, but that antenna is there, yeah. Number nine, one practice that you would keep if everything else fell away.
Kirtan is the end all and the be all. It's the only thing that's keeping me fixed, really. If the whole universe dissolved, if I had that, I would be able to survive.
The last one, number 10, the last question and probably the most important one. Did you watch the World Cup finals of 2022 between Argentina and France?
There is
professional, right? You're a hip hop artist. Hip hop is confessional.
Yeah.
You can make a whole hip hop now confessing.
there is a video of my brother and I when the last penalty was made by Montiel. You know, he made that where we're screaming our brains out of our ears, just like.
So you were supporting me. You were supporting Argentina, okay?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, okay, okay. You are still my friend.
Come on, but the cup had to come back to South America somehow. Okay. You know what I'm saying?
So there is that video. Okay, I won't push you to publish it publicly, but I may request it privately. Okay, that was it. You passed the test. Thank you so much, Bali. And before we end, I don't know if there is anything you'd like to leave with our listeners. Any thought, reflection, something that comes?
I'm just grateful to have this conversation with you, and I hope that, you can pray for me. We need prayers. praying on the behalf of others is something that is, Danya and I have talked about it recently, and I think we should talk about that more in general, praying for others, sincerely.
Take that as service for sure. It will be my prayer. Thanks so much, and hopefully it's reciprocal. Thank you for coming, Bali. It's been a pleasure and honor, and for me a great opportunity to continue getting to know you more and exploring your noble heart. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.